Blog Talk Radio.
So you want your charity to succeed. It's no secret that combining online and offline techniques is the key to modern-day fundraising success, and practical advice is what you need. The Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart is the perfect place to learn from experts around the world who, along with our host, provide advice you can use. Ted Hart is without a doubt one of the foremost nonprofit thought leaders. Also a successful author, his books cover a broad range of topics from major gift fundraising to use of social media and how to succeed online. Ted lectures around the world, but now he's here for you. From the latest in charity news, technology, fundraising, and social networking, Ted and his guests help you maneuver through this economic downturn in the charitable sector to greater levels of efficiency and fundraising success. Remember, this is a live call-in show. Become part of the show by adding your voice. Call now at 347-324-3080. After the show, you can find all our podcasts at tedhart.com. Just click on radio links. Don't forget to dial 347-324-3080. Now, welcome the host of the Nonprofit Coach, Ted Hart.
And welcome here to the latest edition of the Nonprofit Coach. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. This is Thursday, and this is a rare Thursday show for us. Thursday, May 23rd, and I'm coming to you live from the global headquarters of the Charities Aid Foundation of America, CAFAmerica.org. We've got a big show for you today. Of course, we're coming up on, here in the United States, coming up on the Memorial Day holiday. We will share with you the upcoming schedule here on the Nonprofit Coach a little bit later on in the show, but just to make note for all of your calendars that we do not have a live show next Tuesday as we normally would in observance of the Memorial Day holiday here in the United States. As the announcer said, this is a live call-in show, so we do encourage you to call in with your questions at 347-324-3080. You also can join us over in the chat room. I see some folks over in the chat room. You can type out your questions there or email me your questions today at tedhart@tedhart.com. As always, here on the Nonprofit Coach, we start the show off with Page One News. As always, here on the Nonprofit Coach, you can join us online at tedhart.com and receive all of the links for the information that I'm sharing with you today in our radio links. Again, tedhart.com. Click on radio links. Over there today, you will find sent to us from the Chronicle of Philanthropy a new article on why nonprofits should rethink their email campaigns. As more and more people use smartphones rather than computers to check their email, many charities are rethinking the way that they communicate with their supporters and promote their events. This is a very well-written article that gives you some good information, but the bottom line is shorter messages are much more effective in the mobile age. Videos are more like email candy. Recipients can't resist clicking on the play button and sharing them through social media. So once again, as we've said many, many times here on the show, mobile is changing the landscape in terms of how you use email and how you are using social media. Learn all about it over in the radio links today at tedhart.com. Click on radio links, where you will also find sent to us from the fundraisingcoach.com a gift range calculator. And oftentimes, as you are starting to plan for capital campaigns and major gift campaigns, it's hard to necessarily remember all of the details of what would be the gift ranges that you would be looking for. So, for instance, if you are looking to raise $1 million in general, you would need to be able to identify five prospects, all of which who would be able to give a $250,000 gift. You would need to close one of those gifts to meet the basic standard outline of a major gift or capital campaign. Going on down through, you would then need, for instance, 10 prospects able to give $100,000. You would need to close two of those gifts. So use the gift range calculator as a good thumbnail as you're putting together your campaigns. And of course, we know a lot of you folks are looking to year-end giving and in the fall starting to launch some of those larger campaigns. That calculator will help you in your planning, and you can find that again today at tedhart.com. Click on radio links. We also, from time to time, like to bring you a little measure of geek, and coming to us from CNN Tech today. For those of you who have always wondered, how do you pronounce that little GIF when you're sending a little file, a little piece of software, and that's referred to as a GIF file? There's been, I guess, somewhat of the debate, is that a GIF or is that a GIF? Well, it has been settled because the gentleman who created the graphics interchange format, or GIF, has settled that and said that it is, in fact, to be pronounced GIF. Here in the United States, there is a peanut butter known as GIF. So if you think of that, it is officially a GIF and not a GIF file. You can, of course, read all about that and see the gentleman, Steve White, who recently received a Webby Award, and did settle that that issue for all you geeks out there. It is, in fact, a GIF. Also, speaking of a little measure of a geek, and these are sort of junior geeks, Doodle for Google was a contest that was recently put together from Google, where this is an annual program that invites K through 12 students in the United States to use their artistic talents to think big and redesign the homepage logo for millions to see over on Google. There are scholarship dollars hanging in the balance. And we just thought going into the holiday, you might like to see some of the fantastic artwork that was put together. And the winners are noted there over in the radio links today. You can find that under Doodle for Google, and you'll be able to see those award winners. Next up here on the Nonprofit Coach, here in the radio links, we also want to draw attention coming to you from the Content Marketing Institute. Recently just posted Optimizing Your Content Marketing Strategy with 8 Keyword Tracking Tips. So all that information, very well put together, sort of a step-by-step in terms of where you can go and get really good information on the various campaigns that you may be putting together online and how you can track whether or not your keywords are making any difference. That's available over in the radio links today. In addition to Nonprofit Marketing, a quick start guide to fundraising sent to us by Search Engine Watch, that's searchenginewatch.com. In a recent Facebook post, got this author thinking about how you might be able to do a better job marketing your organization. And some of the tips that you'll find here are helping you with timing. Once you've established your event, it's time to come up with a date in the summer. Nearly every weekend is filled with activities. Make sure that you aren't hosting your event on the same day as a similar event. That goes without saying. But what about incentives and branding? How do you spread the word? There's a link here on promoting your event and selling tickets. And then what about social media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, press releases, sponsorships? So this is all outlined for you over in the radio links today under the title Nonprofit Marketing, a quick start guide for fundraising. Next up here on the Nonprofit Coach, as we're starting to wrap up our page one issues today, is 4 ways to find your brand's voice. And this is from one of the smartest websites on the internet. You can find that at Mashable.com, 4 ways to find your brand's voice, such as building archetypes. Now, what does he or she look like in terms of what does your target audience look like? Where does he or she work? What do they care about? What do they do for fun? It also challenges you to fill in the blank with some questions. So let me share some of these with you. Spend a little bit of time answering the following questions, and this will help you find your voice. I want my organization to make people feel blank. Blank makes me feel this way. I want people to blank when they come into contact with my organization. 3 words that describe my organization are blank, blank, and blank. I want to mimic the brand voice of who? I mean, who's out there that's really got a great voice that you wish that your organization was more like? Equally important, I think, is I dislike the brand voice of this other organization. So we want to steer clear of that. And interacting with my donors, donor clients, potential clients makes me feel in what way blank. And also, I really like in this article, finding your muse. What are those organizations out there? And they share some for-profit brands that have particular voices. And what those voices say about you in terms of whether or not you're drawn to those voices or not. So I think finding your muse in terms of where you are taking your organization makes a lot of sense. You'll be able to find that over on Mashable for finding your voice. And with that, it is now time for us to head on over to our Page 2 expert for today. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach a friend and a colleague who I've known for many years and have just been in awe of the wonderful leadership that Janice Galpetti has brought to the nonprofit field. Surprisingly, for more than 25 years, she has been around for a long time, but is youthful as always. She is an internationally recognized authority on fundraising and regularly conducts training and leads presentations for all types of groups and organizations. She has been known for many years as a specialist in diversity and ethics in fundraising issues. Her book, Cultivating Diversity in Fundraising, was published by John Wiley & Sons in 2001 and won the Case International Research Award in 2003. She also served as editor of the New Directions in Philanthropy Fundraising, Diversity in Fundraising Profession, published by Josie Bass in 2002. Just to make note, today's show is part of the Wiley AFP Wiley radio series here on the Nonprofit Coach, a monthly radio series where AFP and John Wiley & Sons brings to our audience here on the Nonprofit Coach the very best in authors from the John Wiley series at AFP. Janice is an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco, where she teaches courses in fundraising, strategic planning, and board governance. She serves on the international board of the Association of Fundraising Professionals and chairs the AFP's Ethics Committee. She also chaired the 2005 Think Tank on Ethics held in Washington, D.C., and Janice has led AFP's 2005 Diversity Summit. For the purposes of today, in addition to the incredible work that she has and the incredible insight that she brings to us, Janice has written a new book, and this is part of the AFP Fund Development Series, known as Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy, a guide to ethical decision-making and regulation for nonprofit organization. Janice currently serves as Vice President for Resource Development at the Asia Foundation, and for that purpose, we have provided you a direct link to Janice's contact information over at the Asia Foundation. In today's radio links at tedhart.com, click on radio links, and now it's my absolute pleasure to welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach, Janice Galpetti.
Thank you so much, Ted, for that warm welcome, and it is indeed an honor to be on your radio talk show.
Well, your expertise, and thank you for that, your expertise is an area of intense interest to the audience of the Nonprofit Coach, both in the nonprofit fundraising strategy area, but also in ethics and diversity, which are topics that everyone wants to get right and everyone wants to understand, but often does come across as more of a mystery. So if you don't mind, I thought we'll get to your book because we definitely want to. It's quite a large book, and you have an awful lot to say there. But if you don't mind, I wanted to start off with the topics that you have been known for many years as one of the top experts in the fundraising profession on the topics of diversity and ethics. And I wondered if you might share some insight there as to while there has been, I think, a very good focus at AFP in drawing these issues forward, why do they continue to be such mysteries for most professionals?
Well, I think to in attempt to demystify why people will say to me, well, why Janice, why diversity, and then why ethics, and how would you bring these together in terms of my own professional career? And this is a bit of background for people who are listening into this call. My ethnicity is I'm a fourth generation Chinese American. Actually, I'm a fourth-generation Californian, a native San Franciscan, to be precise. And when I was a newly minted undergraduate, I received my bachelor's degree. I was in graduate school, and I decided, you know, after all this schooling, there's got to be more in life to this, and now I'm going to show my my age a little bit here. At that point in time, the Peace Corps was a fairly new institution, and as we all probably, you all probably know, it was President Kennedy's cry to, you know, for young people to go out and to be able to help not their own, just their own country, but to work in developing countries. And so I was fortunate enough to be selected as a Peace Corps volunteer, and I was sent to Korea. Now, at that point in time, Korea is not the South Korea that we know today. It was emerging from war. It was poverty-stricken, and the economic situation was dire, to say the least, in that country. As a Asian American female, I was asked to serve as a public health volunteer. Now, mind you, my degree is in English literature, but you know that's neither here nor there.
But roll up your sleeves; you can do almost anything, right?
Right. You know, you can do anything. When you're that age, you think that that's true. There's nothing; you're invincible. So off I went to a very remote fishing village in northeastern Korea, very close to the DMZ, and I was assigned to open a health clinic in that very isolated area. It was a very challenging opportunity for me. I struggled. I was misunderstood. I believe that I, in turn, misunderstood others. And from that, just to make this tale bring it to an end, from that came a lifelong interest in what I'll call diversity, and it's how different cultures come together, how I as an Asian couldn't have been any more like Koreans in that remote fishing village than they could, you know, come to San Francisco and be like me. And so as a result, my entire career in the nonprofit sector, fundraising, this notion of how we understand and learn and work with each other became very important to me, and I'd bring that to my work as both an author and a practitioner, in that I believe that we tend to sometimes categorize a bit when we think about diversifying the fundraising profession. You know, what does it really mean to diversify the fundraising profession? Does it mean that you have more people of color that you bring in and you hire more?
I think a lot of people gravitate towards that, don't they? I mean, it sounds like what you're talking about is cultural awareness, sensitivity, understanding. But I think when people hear diversity, they immediately think, well, we need more faces of color.
Exactly. I mean, you hear that with staff, you hear that with diversifying boards. And so the question that I, posed back in return is, well, is it only because you are a person of color or you represent by race or ethnicity a certain population that qualifies you to be culturally aware and to be sensitive to others? I would suggest, you know, to answer my own question, that no, that's not necessary. So then this brings into, this is where ethics begins to come into the conversation, which is ethics in a very broad sense is an exploration of values. And we all have different sets of values. What we're challenged to do and what we face every day in our professional and personal settings is how do we act in keeping our values intact and perhaps working with those whose values are different than ours. So I'll stop there, but that's kind of a very, you know, lengthy way of introducing why diversity and ethics in my life.
Well, and I'm so glad that you did. I mean, you said an awful lot, but I think it's also very powerful what you just said, because I think that the words diversity and ethics, they get thrown around so much that they sort of take on this mystique that I can't even ask questions about it because I'm expected to know what it is. And until someone like you comes in and helps breaking it down and helping define it in a way that people can make it more approachable, to say, you know, it's not just a matter, as we just mentioned, of just having faces of color, but it's, are you being culturally sensitive? Are you being culturally aware? Are you taking steps to make sure that you have those voices available, whether those voices and that knowledge come from people who actually are of a diverse race versus the majority, or do you have people who have taken the time and spent the time to grow in that understanding and can bring that voice forward as well? And both can be equally valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how do you demystify ethics in the same way? Because I think that's, you know, everyone wants to be ethical. Everybody want. I don't think most people. Of course, there's probably some, but I don't think most people set out to be unethical. But they can end up taking actions that would be seen as unethical.
Yes. Well, right. I don't think that most people wake up in the morning and say, well, I think I'm going to be ethical today, or
right.
conversely,
or not.
You know,
right.
I think I'm going to be unethical today. And if we accept the very general description that I apply to ethics, which is that it is values are a very important part of ethics. It's been said by, you know, great philosophers of the past that what we're looking at as ethical people is to live the good life. And to live the good life is not necessarily that I have all of the material things that I wish to have or make the money that I want to have or whatever, drive the newest car, but to live the good life is to characterize good as a life that gives and a life that is filled with beneficence. And I think that that rings so true for those of us who choose work in the nonprofit sector and more specifically fundraisers. So when we think about ethics, and I often go out and I speak about ethics to groups around the country, around the world, the first thing that I like to say to everyone is that, and I don't have, this is a virtual audience that we have today, but when I'm able to see people face to face, it's that this is not the topic that's going to bring a sparkle to your eye and you're going to straighten up in your chair and think, I have just been waiting for this conversation. This is just what, you know, I want to talk about is ethical fundraising.
Right. That's not usually something that does much more than glaze people's eyes over. But is it because it's something that feels so weighty and distant?
Well, yeah, I think that's right, Ted. I think that the distant part is that it's not concrete. How do you talk about ethics? Of course, you know, it's important, but, you know, I've got more important things to think about in my job. I mean, you know, we have goals to make. We've got a deficit to overcome. We've got to create this. We've got to make our, hit our goals for this capital campaign. But embedded in each of these goals and responsibilities we have every day in so many ways, we deal with decisions that we need to make. And so often those decisions are not singular. They're not made by, I don't make the decision. My job at the Asia Foundation, where I'm the vice president of resource development, We operate in 18 countries throughout Asia. We have offices in 18 countries. We have staff throughout the United States. So we have many people from with various cultural backgrounds, languages spoken. And the decisions that we make are that I often have to make, and the activities that I often am involved in require an understanding of where my colleague is coming from, be it in Nepal or Bangladesh or China, wherever it happens to be. And so ethics, I prefer to kind of tone down the word ethics and to think about what that is, what that means for us, how, where the meaning comes from. And if I might, I'd like to draw this back to my recent book, Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy.
Make that bridge.
Okay. So the recent book, Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy, A Guide to Ethical Decision-Making and Regulation for Nonprofit Organizations, is actually a follow-up to the predecessor book, which was Ethical Fundraising, A Guide for Nonprofit Boards and Fundraisers. And the wonderful people at Wiley, the editors, felt that the word ethical in the former title was a bit off-putting because people will think, well, I'm ethical, so why would I need a book? Right. Why do I need a book on ethical fundraising when I'm ethical? So it's been, this is a little bit more complicated a conversation, but we've moved towards nonprofit fundraising strategy to help people think about how we can apply the components of the ethical code that's espoused by AFP and that I've been a part of for so many years, and other organizations who have similar codes of ethics. How do you actually apply that into your work as a fundraiser? So that's where this particular rather hefty volume is coming from. It's many chapters. It covers many different categories. I'm only the editor of this book. My job was to work with the individual authors and to keep them on task and to make sure that thematically we were moving forward. So I really want to stop here and give great credit to the individual authors who participated by offering chapters for this book. This particular volume has four new chapters. Paul Cribbino.
It's quite a book. It's
a little bit longer than we thought it was going to be, 452 pages, but I think this is the kind of book I encourage people to, you're not going to pick it up and start at page one and end up at page 452, but you will go through the table of contents. Look at these categories, conflicts of interest. This is something that's of interest, of, that resonates with me. What are some ethical considerations of asking for money? What is this about tainted money? Jean Temple wrote that chapter, and I think it's wonderful. And Diane Lister, who wrote on the appearance of impropriety. So I think that in the situations that we face in our roles as fundraisers, this book can serve as a go-to book, and hopefully readers will go to it and look for areas that are of interest to them.
Well, and specific to that, I want to ask you in terms of some of the chapters that you just highlighted there, is being ethical the same as doing the right thing?
Well, I would ask back, what does it mean to do the right thing? You and I could, we've known each other for some time and respect each other a great deal, and yet it's possible that we might disagree on a particular, let's call it a dilemma to, kind of focus it within the ethical context, that we may have differing opinions. Does that mean that one of us is right and the other one is wrong?
Well, is being ethical an absolute?
Well, there are those who believe if one has... let me answer that in two ways. One is that to have a code, as members of AFP have and subscribe to and promise to adhere to as members of the organization, suggests that there are ways of behaving that are unethical, which could similarly suggest that that means the converse is that one can be unethical. But I believe that when we think about doing the right thing or being ethical, I strip this down, Ted, to the whole issue of process and narrative. If you and I disagree with something, or we have an ethical dilemma that we're faced with, how do we go about resolving that ethical dilemma? And I'm going to step away from code right now, and I'm going to go back to what I feel so strongly about in terms of values and being able to be respectful and try to understand others' opinions. Is that when we have a potential conflict of interest or an appearance of impropriety, what's really critical is that we, as we address that dilemma, engage in a fact-finding, if you will, understanding as many components of what causes this dilemma as possible, rather than moving into a rather linear state of, well, we've got to go through a process to determine whether this is right or wrong, and then we'll determine, what the action needs to be. That in my mind, the process, the narrative, the conversation is an incredibly integral part of what I consider to be the ethical life of a fundraiser, to be very specific about it.
Mm-hmm. But when you put in those terms, ethics appears to be connected to community. In other words, if you choose to be part, as you and I do, be part of a community of international fundraisers, and that particular community requires that you subscribe to a set of guidelines known as a code of ethics, then those are the guidelines for that community. It's possible for people to be a fundraiser and not subscribe to that, but this particular community sets forth a set of guidelines that we would see not acting in accord with that code. We would see those activities as unethical.
Yeah. You know, some years ago, AFP engaged in a series of conversations, discussions with colleagues from international institutions around the possibility of creating an international code of ethics. And I think that this was a valiant effort that was premised on only good intent. But what many discovered in this process is that coming up with an international code of ethics, you know, this is a community, a broader community, agreeing on what might be those agreed upon values. The best that could come from this are a strong set of guidelines, a strong set of this is how we shall behave and work with each other. But it was not possible to come up with this code of ethics that would apply around through different cultures.
So not only is, well, I guess it's the same, it could be seen as the same thing, but it's not only community-driven, but intrinsic to various cultures.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That there can be difference. So that would tend to, and again, you're the expert, so I'm asking these questions of you. So it would tend to suggest that ethics is not an absolute, that ethics is tied to guidelines that are agreed to either culturally or by community.
Well, first of all, you flatter me unnecessarily by calling me an expert. I don't think that I spent a lot of time and am deeply interested in the topic of ethics and ethical fundraising, but I wouldn't call myself an expert in that I am not steeped academically in the fields of philosophy and ethics. So to talk about what ethics is and isn't, you know, we may have people who are far more familiar with, you know, that sense of how we approach the field as I am. But I do believe, I mean, it's my personal opinion that we cannot, when we talk about ethics, we are talking about, as you put it, community. As I describe it, values, and that we have to integrate various cultural opinions. And those cultural opinions don't have to be driven by race or ethnicity. They can be economic. They can be, you know, any number of ways that we can look at how we differ from each other.
Exactly, and it's through those differences that we can learn to understand each other and to grow as human beings. We are live here today on the Nonprofit Coach with Janice Galpetti. We do intend to speak specifically about more of the details in her book, Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy. We're going to take a quick break, and Janice, when we come back, I do want to get into some of your tips from this guidebook. So we will be right back after this break. Couple of things I just want to note for your calendar. I mentioned earlier that due to the Memorial Day holiday here in the United States, we will not have a live show as we normally would on the 28th of May. So that's a great day to catch up on shows that you may have missed. course, all the shows of The Nonprofit Coach are available on iTunes and available via your computer or your smartphone at tedhartradio.com, so you can listen to it anywhere. Take us to the beach and catch up with some of the experts from around the world that we have here on The Nonprofit Coach. We'll be right back after that holiday with Andrea Kilstedt in her new book, Fundraising Power, here on The Nonprofit Coach on June 4th, and that's, of course, at our regularly scheduled time of 12 noon Eastern. Then we have a very special show for you planned for June 10th. We want to draw your attention to the work of the Charities Aid Foundation of America, of which I serve as CEO, and over on CAF America Radio Network on June 10th at a very special time, 10 a.m., coming to you live from Singapore. We will be announcing the CAF America Asia Pacific Advisors Service, and the show will be about best practices of giving in the Asia Pacific region. Of course, CAF America has been giving and making grants into the Asia Pacific region on behalf of our donor clients for more than 21 years, and this is a highlight of those services and enhancements to those services. You'll be able to listen live on the CAF America Radio Network, June 10th at 10 a.m., and, of course, that information is all available over in the radio links at tedhart.com. What I want to do now is just share with you a little bit about a new service available from Google, and then we're going to head right back over live with our Page 2 expert today, Janice Galpetti.
Life gets busy. Wouldn't it be nice to have a central place where you could save what's on your mind? With Google Keep, you can stay on top of your world by quickly and easily organizing everything you want to remember. No matter where you are,
finalize door list for Thursday's gig.
So when you find inspiration, you can file away your ideas. And Google Keep stores them safely across all your devices. And when the time comes, you'll have everything covered. Save what's on your mind. Google Keep.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at tedhart.com. Click on Radio Links. If you're listening live today, the phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 347-324-3080. Now, back to The Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart.
And we're back here live with Janice Galpetti of the Asia Foundation and noted expert on issues related to cultural sensitivity, diversity, and ethics. And in her terrific new book, which is part of the AFP Fund Development Series called Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy, A Guide to Ethical Decision-Making and Regulation for Nonprofit Organizations. Janice, welcome back here. The foreword to this book is written by a terrific colleague of ours, Andrew Watt, who's the president and CEO of AFP. Talk to us about why it's significant to have Andrew Watt writing the introduction or the foreword to a book of this sort.
Andrew is a former member of AFP's Ethics Committee. So when he first came to AFP, one of his first roles was to serve as a volunteer member when he was still working in the UK. Andrew brings a strong vision and international understanding of what ethical fundraising implies for us as fundraisers. Beyond that, Andrew, in his current role as the president and CEO of AFP, serves as, he's the face of AFP in many ways. And Andrew believes, he walks the talk when it comes to the code of conduct and ethics as a core value in the work of the Association of Fundraising Professionals. So I was deeply gratified and honored when Andrew agreed to write the foreword for this book. I think that, without going into great detail there, he points out rightfully in the foreword that, 4 or 5 years ago when Ethical Fundraising, the predecessor book, came out, it was a valiant effort, and my colleague said, okay, well, you know, Janice really wants to put this book together, so we're going to rally behind her and we'll do it. But it didn't have a lot of, wow, this is really important. And then he says, you know, fast forward to where we are in 2012, 2013. And look at where we stand in terms of the nonprofit sector with regard to how important public trust is to our existence. And how many times do we need to be addressing loss of public trust? And so this, as Andrew says, writes in the foreword, ethical fundraising becomes even more important than ever to more people. So I am grateful to him for that work.
Well, I am as well, and I knew that you would if I asked you that question. You went specifically where I wanted you to go, and that is this issue of public trust. And it seems to me that all of these issues are related, and how you've put this book together is absolutely brilliant. In walking us through that process of understanding that as we see public trust in so many sectors of our society being questioned or potentially even being damaged. Is that not an issue for the nonprofit sector, for everyone to get beyond the word ethics, beyond some of the other words that can sort of get in the way of an understanding of what you're trying to accomplish here, and really understand that the bottom line here is that we're stewards of public trust. And that's the very nature of why our organizations have the tax status that they have, that they are organized in the way that they are, and that without that common understanding that binds us together as a community, again, going back to standards of community, then we lose sight of what it is that we do.
Yeah. I mean, I well said, Ted. I agree completely. I mean, without public trust, fundraising can't happen, simply put. You know, we as those who seek charitable dollars cannot do this. If the public chooses to or loses trust in us, and I might add that to that, we have to be mindful of public opinion and how public opinion is articulated. At least within the United States, the media has a very important role here. It takes one scandal within a nonprofit organization and for the news media to pick it up. And then, you know, how it's what has gone wrong. We've seen it so many times. And I think that we, in our work, are entrusted with being able to articulate to those who will support us why we deserve that trust. We do that in action. We do that in word. It's in a very small way. It's why this book exists, is to provide a guideline, if you will, or just a place where there's some opportunity for a fundraiser to go to and to seek some guidance in terms of how might I act or how might my organization act if we're faced with a conflict of interest, if we're looking at compensation as an ethical dilemma. I mean, you know, you don't think of that as being high on the scale of ethical issues, but it's a very important one. In the book, we have a new section on the ethics assessment inventory, which is a tool that was developed by Bob Shoemake and his colleagues in the Midwest to help members of AFP kind of benchmark their own responses to certain ethical situations. And then the other piece that I want to touch on that's in the new book, Nonprofit Fundraising Strategy, are the new business practice codes. Now, for years, AFP's code, and I'd just like to take a second and go reflect on AFP's code of ethics. The code is applied, as I said earlier, and as you know, and many of the listeners know, to the members of AFP. Increasingly, over the years, we have engaged a number of members who represent the business side of the work we do. They're vendors, they're consultants, and they are participants. They want to support the code. And so about, I think it was maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, we created new code, added new code, and brought in codes that are specific to business members. So this applies to a business who might be a small business to a large vendor in, say, technology. But they this code is now accepted and is incorporated and is part of the membership so that business members themselves have the opportunity to say that they will also abide by AFP's code of ethics.
And I think that's a big advance forward, don't you?
Oh, yes. I think it's a big step forward. I think that it's also a step forward. I, you know, by no means are we, you know, at the this is the end of the road where we can say, well, we've done it. Let's have a celebration now. I mean, that we've, you know, succeeded in embracing all of the constituents around a code of ethics. I think that this is part of what the AFP Ethics Committee does. And I am no longer active on the committee. I was termed out, so I serve as chair emeritus. But the committee is charged with two major responsibilities. One of those is education, and the other is enforcement. The enforcement is to be the arbitrating body, if you will, in the case of when there are infractions or violations of the code, and I'm not going to go into that on this call unless anyone wants to get into that. But I wanted to focus just a few words around the educational part, and that's the piece that is so essential to our ability to be what we would call ethical as fundraisers, to educate, to talk with each other. I enjoy when I'm asked to go out and speak. This is about ethics, something that I absolutely love doing. The opportunity to be a speaker on a guest on your call today is not only an honor, but it's a great opportunity to also encourage people to think about how might we educate ourselves, our donors, our colleagues, our boards on what it does mean to be ethical institutions.
And it's interesting. I'm just reading an email. I just got an email in from William in Chicago, and I just wonder what you think about this. He's raising the specter of the Arimony United Way scandal,
mm-hmm.
and what relationship that had to putting these topics on the table.
Well, I think that the Arimony scandal was one of the earliest publicized scandals to hit the nonprofit sector. And Arimony, who was the Bill Arimony, who was the president of United Way of America, was, you know, when I talked earlier about ethics being a value or a demonstration of living the good life, you know, we could take that phrase, living the good life, and apply it to him and his behavior in the negative, in terms of using his position in power, using resources that were donated to the organization for charitable purposes, for personal gain. This was all very troubling. The interesting thing about Bill Arimony, and unfortunately, you know, there have been way too many people who have followed in his footsteps, is that not only were there ethical challenges and ethical dilemmas and just breaches of ethical conduct, but there were laws that were broken. And I just want to point out that when we talk about ethics and we talk about law, I mean, ethics and law are not, you know, they to be ethical and to be within the law are two separate conversations.
Exactly. And that's where it comes to guidelines and as you said, even the issue of sort of self-policing.
Mm-hmm.
Or early
and
industry policing.
Absolutely, and self-policing. I mean, you know, how do we feel about the possibility? It's been posed on Capitol Hill and in other places that perhaps the nonprofit sector needs, if it can't regulate itself, meaning demonstrate its good stewardship, should there not be government oversight of them? And you know, to this I say, well, do we really want that? I mean, you know, government oversight of the nonprofit sector might have a, it might change the nonprofit sector significantly. For the best.
And I think it brings us to, bring this to sort of current day, and this is a show that my listeners know we are, staunchly nonpartisan on this show. But I think seeing what's happening with the IRS and the congressional discussions right now, the concern that I have is sort of the confusion that creates in the marketplace of ideas when it comes to what is a nonprofit. When we have groups that are very blatantly, and this comes in both sides of the aisle, mm-hmm. very blatantly utilizing sort of that public sector nonprofit approach to politicize the messages and to seek tax advantage to do that. And I think that creates confusion.
Yeah, it's very troubling. I like many people, am learning from what I hear and read, and I find it to be troubling is the word. I mean, in terms of the very existence of the 501c3 status and how that might be interpreted differently for different organizations is a very troubling thought.
Yeah, it really is. I'm mindful of the time that we have left here, and as you said, this is quite a lengthy book, an awful lot of thought leaders in this book. I wanted to just ask you to sort of maybe wrap things up for us here, looking at the other side of your topic that you've chosen. We've spent quite a bit of time on ethical decision making, but what about regulation?
Regulation. Well, I believe that AFP is, and I will speak as a member of AFP right now, looking very carefully and I think accurately in terms of the relationship that the organization has with the leaders on Capitol Hill. I'm not going to address regulation per se because I think that aside from my earlier comment that I believe that as stewards of the public trust, we have a responsibility to be accountable to our donors. And within that context, I believe we are required to regulate ourselves, that there is a measure of regulation that comes from that very responsibility that's given to us. Regulation in another context is that which is of oversight, and the oversight which has rules, policies, a code of conduct, and a code of ethics can be viewed as regulation. And I have a belief that guidelines are important, but inherently, and I'll try to sum this up, inherently it's the decisions that we make as individuals. It's the values, to go back to what I started the conversation on with values. It's the values and it's the respectfulness that we bring to our work that's going to help the public understand and reinforce why we deserve and need to continue to earn the public trust. Regulation's important, but regulation isn't going to be the answer to situations that we face right now.
So going back to where we started the show, it comes back to community standards and holding each other accountable?
Yes, absolutely. It goes back to boards. It takes a look at how are we organized. So we have governing boards. Our boards are volunteers. A board member, what gain does a board member have for sitting on a nonprofit board? They are a part of helping to fulfill a mission. They are fiduciary stewards. The stewardship of the mission of the organization is important. And so it is about, trust. The capital that we hold is trust.
And do you think that as a sector we're doing well with that, or are we in danger?
I think that we should not be overly alarmed. I think that there are those who would, we hear these situations and they make us cringe feel like, well, what is this all coming to? I think that the 200 years plus that we have of philanthropy in the United States, we've got so much that we can look back on and be proud of, and we need to continue to use that as the standard to help us continue to move forward. The conditions that we're moving into, Ted, our communities are changing, and we need to be mindful of how these communities change. Are we honoring, are we embracing, are we inclusive of the people and the values that are shaping the world of 2013, the philanthropic world of 2013.
Well, I think you raised such an important topic there, because what of the difference in cultures? And we already established that, ethics are not an absolute but are tied to culture and community. What takes a precedent if you are becoming a bigger community and embracing more cultures? How do you change your ethical view to take those cultures into account? Or do the cultures have to change to the community standards?
I think that there's an organic response to that, and I think that it's the institution, as it strategically and mindfully embraces new communities, new programs, new values, and is sensitive to its mission and why it exists, that in that organic development of bringing people to the table of decision-making, of influence, who are representative of the populations who are being served, that's going to bring, for example, to the board table, a new dialogue, and that dialogue needs to take place.
As we wrap up, we only have a couple minutes left. I'm just wondering what advice you have for our listeners about these challenges that they'll be facing in the months and years ahead.
The advice is, as a person who's asked that question a lot, I like to reply somewhat flippantly that, people who are ethicists, if you will, and I don't go as far as to call myself an ethicist, but what we're good at is we ask a lot of questions. We're not so good at perhaps giving, answers, because answers tend to be absolute. And so I'd say that there's some value to asking questions, open-ended questions, questions that are designed to help us think beyond where we are today, look to where we want to be 5 years, 10 years, a generation down the road.
And that's really a good standard, isn't it, is to try to look forward and not just look back?
We have to look back, because our history does inform who we are, but I think we use history as we look forward, and that's where we are in the present, is we're able to take our history and we're able to be focused on the future.
What's next for Janice Galpetti and the evolution of her role in help guiding all of us in the sector in the topics of diversity and ethics?
Oh, I don't know. It's been I've enjoyed every minute of my involvement with putting these books together, and I love having the opportunity to engage in conversation with people about the issues and the challenges framed around ethical behavior. So I'll just keep on doing what I do, and I'm looking for the people who are coming alongside of me and the next generation of leaders who are really going to be able to take us off into that future of unknown possibilities.
Well, that's great. Well, this has been live here on the Nonprofit Coach with Janice Galpetti. Janice, you've just given us so much guidance and so much to think about, very important topics, as you always do. Remember, everyone, that we will be away next week, so we will be back here live on the Nonprofit Coach with you on June 4th at 12 noon Eastern, and that was our latest edition of the Nonprofit Coach. Thank you for joining us today. Catch you in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach Radio Show with Ted Hart. Tell all your friends to check out our production schedule and download our iPod and iPad-friendly podcast at tedhart.com. Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Coach.